Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
From MaximumFun.org and NPR, it's Bullseye. Chloe Sevigny is my first guest this week. She is very cool. She started out as a model, then she started appearing in music videos for bands like Sonic Youth and the Lemonheads. Then she was an actor in arthouse movies. Her debut was in Larry Clark's pioneering film, Kids. Then she went on to bigger things, an Oscar-nominated role in Boys Don't Cry, roles in indie films like The Last Days of Disco and Broken Flowers, regular jobs on shows like Big Love and American Horror Story. Her latest project is The Girl from Plainville. It's a TV drama series inspired by the so-called texting suicide case. Conrad Roy III was 18 years old when he died by suicide in 2014. Roy's girlfriend, the then 17-year-old Michelle Carter, was charged and later convicted in connection to his death. The series explores the events leading up to Roy's death and the relationship he and Carter shared. In this clip from the show's pilot, Conrad's family is getting ready for his funeral. His mom, Lynn, played by Chloe, asks her daughter for her thoughts about an outfit she has picked out.
Well, how about this one? Sid?
Yeah?
How about this?
It's fine.
You would have told me, right?
What?
If you knew he was thinking about it?
Yeah.
I don't know why I asked it. Coco's friend, that girl, Michelle. Such a sweet girl.
She texted you again?
Yeah, she's hurting. I think she wants to be close to us or something. Did you know they were so close?
Sorta.
You left her a note.
What did it say?
A lot. He loved her.
Chloe, welcome to Bullseye. I'm happy to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jesse. Happy to be here.
Did you think about, when you were preparing for this, did you think about what kind of teenager you were?
No, I'm more thinking about that and processing the work post-haste, which is generally my process. I kind of make sense of it afterwards in a way, which is backwards, I know. I guess preparing for press, like I more kind of reflect on it. I think while I'm in it, it's more instinctual.
What kind of reflections have you made in preparing to do press? What have you thought about?
I thought about, yeah, my own adolescence. And the security and love I had from my family, and yet I still struggled. I wouldn't say I struggled with depression, but I mean, I was hormonal and had problems that lots of teenagers have. Then as a parent, like, how do you read that? I guess I was thinking, you know, now I'm a mother and thinking about my son, and when he becomes a teenager, like, how do you know if it's serious or not? And that to me is terrifying. Because like Lynn thought that Coco was on the up and up. He was, you know, thinking about going to school. He just gotten his captain's license. They went to the beach. He was like going to visit his friend at school. Things seemed fine. And then that night, he took his life. And she thought they were very close. I imagine she wanted to be, you know, really involved, but not intrusive. Like, that's the sense of her that I got from watching her interviews. But how does one know? I mean, we're dealing with a mental health crisis in America right now. And, you know, and we see, you know, very successful, happy, beautiful people suffering and all walks of life. You know, it's like there's no guarantees. So I guess, yeah, I'm mostly terrified going forward how to interpret my teen's feelings.
Was it appealing to work as a sort of down-to-earth mom?
Yes, I think over the years in my career, I've played a lot of very grounded characters and kind of the moral compass of many a story and or film. And I think, yeah, showrunners, directors see something of that in me, this, you know, quote unquote realness. But when I was offered The Girl from Plainville and I watched the documentary on HBO, I Love You Now, Die, I was just very taken by Lynn, by her personality and that she put forward in the documentary. Because, you know, whenever there's a camera on, we give a certain version of ourselves. And I'm sure she was protecting certain aspects. But I was just taken. Taken by her humor and her attitude and just the way she spoke.
It feels like it would be a hard place to live as an actor for the amount of time that it takes to make a series that's as sort of long and deep as this. You know, this isn't 2 weeks of work. You know what I mean?
No, it was about 5 months. My son was just over a year and I live in New York City and we were shooting in Savannah. So I was going back and forth a lot and there was a lot of time away from him. So it was kind of like a double whammy, dealing with the subject matter and then dealing with my first time away from him and then what that would mean going forward. You know, I'm an actress. This is my career and I love it. And I have a lot of great opportunities and I hope to continue to have those. But what is it going to mean moving forward doing this? So it was a lot to kind of think about and take in and process. And
especially when you're doing a story that's about a character trying to understand where they were connected and disconnected from their kid.
Yeah, it was a pretty painful place to be for 5 months.
Did you have a plan for how you were going to have a kid in your life and how you were going to integrate your family and professional lives? Like, did you always have a scheme, or was it something that you were like, well, something will happen and I will figure it out?
No, he was a happy accident. Yeah, I had him later. I was 45. I struggled earlier in my life with conception. And so he came along. We're like, we're just going to figure it out. Yeah, it was like the best thing to ever happen to either of us.
More Bullseye still to come after the break. Clothes talk. That's right. I get to talk about clothes with fashion icon Chloe Sevigny. It's very fun. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries Black Twitter, A People's History from Onyx Collective and Hulu. Directed by Prentice Penny, executive producer of Insecure, Black Twitter, A People's History, tells the story of how Black voices found a new home online and blossomed into a force for change while laying down some hilarious tweets along the way. From the memes to the movements, see how this powerful community shapes culture, society, and politics. Black Twitter, A People's History, is now streaming on Hulu.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Chloe Sevigny. She is, of course, an actor and model. She starred in indie films like Kids, Dogville, and American Psycho. She was nominated for an Academy Award for her part in the 1999 drama Boys Don't Cry. These days, you can see Sevigny in the TV shows The Girl from Plainville and Russian Doll, which are airing now on Hulu and Netflix, respectively. Let's get back into our conversation. What kind of teen were you before you, you know, like when you were in your late teens, when you were 17 or 18 or something, you sort of embarked upon your career. You started modeling and ended up acting and et cetera. But before that, what kind of teen were you?
Like junior high or like freshman, sophomore year?
I'm talking about 14 and 15. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think junior high, I was pretty happy. I was like, just, you know, into like playing softball and Esprit clothing and like, you know, going to the pizza parlor and hanging out at the beach. And I was pretty popular. I also grew up, you know, in a really wealthy community without as much as everyone else. So there was always a little bit of a divide. And I think around that age, I started kind of distancing myself from some of the more popular cliques. But my town was really small and I'd known everyone since kindergarten. So you're just basically all together, you know. And then when I got into high school, my brother dated this girl that was from California and she had purple hair and wore Doc Martens and kilts. And or I guess maybe that was eighth grade. And I became like obsessed with her. And I was like, I want to be like, quote unquote, alternative. Maybe that was eighth grade, because I remember my first day of eighth grade, I wore like striped stockings to school and like this mock neck knit two-piece outfit and like shell-toe Doc Martens or something. So yeah, that must have been eighth grade when I started the alternative vibes or aspirations. When I was like, okay, I don't want to be the Esprit girl. I'm looking for something else, which was hard to find where we lived.
Did you grow up in a family where that was unusual or expected?
Well, my brother was doing it. So it was kind of like, you know, he was paving the way. And my father was a bit of an outsider. So,
yeah. The reason I ask is because, like, I know almost nothing about your parents, but there's like a line in a bio somewhere or something that said that your dad was an accountant and later an art teacher. And I was like, oh, well, I don't know what that is.
Yes, I think he had always had aspirations to be an artist and his family was pretty conservative and he went the business route. And I think he was always, you know, kind of kicking himself for not being true to who he was. So they encouraged it. My brother and I, like I actually started acting when I was quite young. I went to summer theater camp in kindergarten and then I was doing, you know, plays in school and summer theater camp and started doing commercials. I was in a Voltron commercial, I think in first or second grade, and was doing like catalog modeling in Connecticut. And so people think that this happened like in my later teens, but it was something I had aspired to since a very young age.
I'm really excited to learn about this Voltron situation.
Like, go Voltron Force, yes.
you drop that one in there like we were going to slide past it, but I think we need to address these.
The poor man's Transformer.
Maybe the rich man's Transformer, Voltron. Voltrons were pretty cool.
I was the pink lion.
So was it one of those kind of commercials? I'm sorry that I'm going to ask you about this and
it's
not
okay.
the many wonderful works of art that you've created in your long career, but I am excited to talk about Voltron for a second. Was it one of those kind of television commercials where there's kids in kind of a featureless black box and they're like holding the toy and the toy's in the foreground and the kids are in the background. They're going like, yeah, shoot, bah, do. You know what I mean?
You got it. We must be in the same age bracket. And then you're like playing with them and, you know, yeah. And then you become them.
Then there's like a voiceover that says like, you got to do it in the crossfire or whatever. That rules. I mean, I feel like that is a very that's pretty much the most prestigious thing you could do as a 10-year-old or 8-year-old. I'm trying to think of something more prestigious than that. I'm struggling. Major League Baseball player, but that seems unlikely.
Yes, I'm pretty proud of my work in the Voltron commercial, to say.
Did you, was there a time when you stopped doing that?
Yes. I think when I started, like, 13, kind of ugly duckling, losing my teeth. And I remember, like, we went to the dentist to get, like, a bridge to fill in some gaps for, like, the auditions. And my mom's like, this is getting out of hand. And I think there was a lot of rejection. And I think, honestly, she was tired of, like, dragging me into the city and these big cattle call, like, environments. And she's like, no more of this. You know, you can go back to professional, you know, when you're 18.
How did you feel about it at the time?
I think I was okay with it. I remember there was another girl in my school that was much more successful. She got a lot more commercials and modeling jobs. And she was much prettier. And so I think at too young of an age, I was really comparing myself to specifically her and then, yeah, other girls.
How did you feel about going on auditions for things that you didn't get?
I mean, I wasn't really that gregarious. Like, I think that I was probably a pretty awkward kid. I think that I just, like, I knew I wanted to do it and I was good at it, like, at camp. But, like, I wasn't, like, turning it out, you know? So it was awkward. I don't know. I think I just, like, I'd seen Annie on Broadway. I was obsessed with Little House, you know, Different Strokes. Like, I was seeing kids on TV doing this. And I was like, you know, Drew and E.T., all of this. Like, I was like, I want to do what all these kids are doing.
At what point did you learn to sew?
I think I had, like, a Fisher-Price sewing machine somewhere in grade school. And my mom taught me to use it. And I would make, like, dolls' clothes.
Did your mom make clothes?
She didn't, but she could, you know, she could, she was better at hand sewing than the machine. But she was very crafty, my mom, and we always did a lot of crafty things at home. And a lot of, like, you know, traditional, like, female-y things, tropes-y, housewife-y things. Gardening, cooking, sewing, yeah.
I mean, all of those are pretty great things.
They are.
I'm not into crafting myself. Anytime I try and do that, it feels like I'm setting myself up for failure.
But we would, like, make donuts and ice cream and, you know, all kinds of fun things as well. Yeah.
What kind of donuts did you make?
I don't remember. She had some sort of donut making device.
Did you make clothes for yourself when you were when you got good at it?
I did. Yeah, I made a lot. I was more like reworking stuff, and I make some stuff from scratch as well. Yeah, I started that kind of like, yeah, probably eighth grade, and then, like, yeah, through high school. But I got really into. I had these, like, alternative years. My older brother was, like, alternative and punky, and I was into his scene in freshman year and. Very into, like, you know, all the classic 90s alternative and 80s. And there was, like, a hardcore club near us in Connecticut that we used to go to. And then I think summer between, like, freshman and sophomore, we were, like, an outdoor festival. And I might have done a hallucinogenic. And I met a boy there. And he had really long hair. And he was Argentinian and really beautiful. And he was really into the Grateful Dead. And so I kind of, like, segued into a little bit of that scene for a while. And there was a lot of dressmaking involved in that.
Were they, like, prairie dresses?
Yes. They're called spinner dresses specifically. Yes. They're like an empire waist with, like, a bigger skirt. Lots of patchwork involved for spinning because you just kind of spin, you know. People think there's, like, a lot of noodling, which is a really unfortunate word. But no, it was more the spinning that I was into. So I'd make the outfits that kind of go with that. Yeah. And you would sell them at the shows, you know. It was a whole culture. Still is.
I love the entrepreneurial aspect of this.
Yeah, that's like the very much of the scene, you know, like Shakedown Street on the lot, like kids like, you know, paying their way or making their way through tour by selling stuff and ground scoring, you know, people just like run through the venues at the ends and like pick up change or whatever they found that people had dropped, you know, and you know, it was ground scoring.
This is some like
this is a deep dive into Dead World.
I'm loving learning about this. I'm from the inner city. I don't know anything about this stuff. Even inner city San Francisco, they don't have this.
Yes, they do. Come on. Especially in San Francisco.
So, like, by the time you started wandering off by yourself, which seems to have been in your, like, mid-teens, mm-hmm. That you were either, like, going away for the weekend by yourself, were you still in hallucinogens and calico dresses mode?
Kind of both. I was kind of like dipping my toes in like all these different worlds. Like I started working at Polo Ralph Lauren, and that was when like all the like the hip hop kids were getting really into Polo. They were called Low Lifes, and they would like, and I so that kind of there was like also the D-Light kind of like raver, hippie, homegirl, alterna girl, kind of like it all started churning into one. And the kids used to come to the mall and they'd be like, oh, Chloe, you have any teddy bear sweaters? And I would like bring them out for them from the back. Teddy bear sweaters were the big thing. But yeah, I was kind of like a jack of all. I was like, I was just into like youth culture, except surfing. That was like the one youth culture I had zero interest in.
Did you think you were going to be an actor? Like you started acting, it's not like you started acting like by like going to theater school and then like showing up with headshots at agents' offices, I don't think. But like, was it your goal to be working actor?
It was when I was younger and like through, you know, junior high. And then when I got into high school, I got into other things that teenagers get into that lead them astray, which unequivocally did. And I kind of lost interest in a lot of extracurricular and, you know, school in general. So I think I auditioned for the drama club and I just didn't click with the teacher in high school. I remember senior year, I auditioned for West Side Story. I had a shaved head, so I auditioned to play a boy part, which was very ahead of its time. And I didn't get the part, so I ended up working in costumes. And I think...
You didn't get any part?
No. She held it against... She had a thing against me. She didn't like me. But boy, did I prove her wrong.
Could you sing and dance?
I could sing, yeah. And I think around then I was very into like fashion and I thought I wanted to go into costumes or maybe work in a magazine. I had interned at Sassy magazine and in the fashion department. And I was kind of unsure of what I wanted to do, but, you know, I wanted to do, yeah, something in fashion or film. And, you know, I started doing music videos. I did the Sonic Youth video. I had met Harmony Korine, who became like a very near and dear friend. And I was just surrounding myself and very attracted to people that were like doing stuff. So yeah, I was driven, but I didn't know to what end.
But you were trying to figure out like, well, I have to work to eat and work. Just the meeting the bare standard of working as an actor is a hard standard to me.
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely paycheck to paycheck until Big Love. And that's, I think, when a lot of the fashion stuff entered the picture. Because I was like, wow, look at this big money, you know, like one day selling out, quote unquote, which people don't really think of it as now. But then it was a serious, you know, thing for me. Like, I was really torn about doing that kind of stuff then. And I remember my brother being like, our dad would have to work a year to make that much money, or, you know, take the money and run. Thank God I followed his advice. Because now it doesn't matter.
Are you ready to play Spider-Man?
What is that?
Spider-Man, he's like a guy that got bitten by a radioactive spider and he shoots webs. They make a lot of movies
yes,
about
Yes, I
him.
Think my brother was him for Halloween once or twice in the 70s.
Were you not going out on auditions to be in Armageddon or whatever? Or were you going to those things and people were thinking that you were too cool for school or whatever?
I think a little both. I was in New York because my mom was, you know, in Connecticut. And like I said, my father had passed. So I never made the leap because I wanted to be close to her. And, you know, pre-9/11, there still were a lot of auditions in New York. But after that, there was not, you had to go to LA. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think I was competing with like the Liv Tylers or Claire Danes of that day. I was, you know, I was like auditioning for like, you know, the sidekick of the funny girl. Those kinds of things.
A couple steps removed. You were moving your way from branch to branch down the tree of the call sheet.
Yeah.
I want to play a scene from one of the movies that you made in the relatively early days of your career, not the very beginning, but the relatively early days of your career, okay. The Last Days of Disco.
Oh yeah, great movie.
It's such a great movie, and
I mean, how do you top that? I mean, one of your first movies is Last Days of Disco. You're like, excuse me, give me something better.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to just do any other thing once you had done a Whit Stillman thing. The most Whit Stillman-y of all things is all Whit Stillman things.
I mean, I had a lot of heavy hitters early on. It was really hard to top that.
So the movie is about kind of the very beginning of the 80s and a bunch of young adults, Ivy League young adults. And in this scene, the character Alice, who my guest Chloe plays, has just finished up a date with a guy named Jimmy, and they're at his house, and Alice finds his Scrooge McDuck comic books.
What's this?
I collect original edition Scrooge McDuck comics. No, it sounds a little odd.
Not at all.
This is original artwork by Carl Barks, who created the Uncle Scrooge comics. He's considered a bit of a genius.
There's something really sexy about Scrooge McDuck.
You really think so?
Did you feel like you had a sense of what you were good at and weren't good at as an actor? Like, did you feel like you were playing to your strengths, or was it like an ideological feeling?
Remember a lot of Last Days of Disco being like, I have no idea what I'm saying. What is this movie? What are we doing? But I think I was good at like, yeah, just keeping it grounded and nuanced. Like, I'm always trying to get back to the performance in The Last Days of Disco. I think it's one of my best performances. I'm always trying to get back to that kind of acting.
What about it do you like, retrospectively?
There's just something unselfconscious in it, even though the dialogue is so self-conscious. Yeah, it's nuanced, it's internal, it's, you know, quiet, it's, yeah.
I mean, I think that's one of your strongest qualities as an actor, that you are interesting to see do person stuff. You know what I mean?
Mm. Do person stuff?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's you don't have to scream and yell to be interesting to watch do something on screen.
I hate yelling. I'm really bad at yelling on screen. I just like, I did Russian Doll in like season two, and there's this one scene where I have to do a lot of yelling, and Natasha's one of my oldest friends, and I remember her like cracking up and being like, all right, everybody, Chloe hates yelling. She just knows, because whenever we go to the theater, I'm like, why is everybody yelling? I think that comes from my mother.
What about other big things on screen? Do you feel like you're comfortable going through, you know, paroxysms of tears or whatever?
Yeah, tears.
T-
tears are good for me. That's a comfortable place. It's a strong suit. Yeah. Running, terrible.
Why do you think yelling is hard and tears less so?
I think yelling because I don't like the texture of my voice when I yell, and I forget to like yell from my diaphragm. So you said it's something like cringy, you know? Tears are, yeah, I don't know. Something I do a lot of, so I like. It's a comfort zone.
We'll wrap up with Chloe Sevigny in just a minute. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Osea. The secret to summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Undaria Algae Body Oil, designed to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Its signature scent, a blend of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin, will transport you to sun-kissed summer days. Get ready for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.
Max Fun Drive 2022 starts in just 1 week.
Monday, April 25th.
We'll have exclusive Max Fun Drive gifts, awesome episodes, bonus content, and you know what else? You'll just have to tune in.
We have some tricks up our sleeve. Sleeves? Tricks? Is it plural?
We'll catch you next week, the greatest time to support the podcasts you love. Max Fun Drive starts on Monday, April 25th.
Don't miss it.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Chloe Sevigny. Let's get back into our conversation. Do you feel like you could be happy and fulfilled if you had a job, the kind of acting job where your skill and talent is a vessel for a machine that makes something that people enjoy, but like you also just get to go there on Monday from Monday to Friday, 9 to 5?
If we're talking procedural, no. I always have a hard time doing procedural. I've tried over and over, and
because you can't do the exposition.
I can, and I've done some of that recently. But yeah, it's not that fulfilling. Yeah, for me. But if it's shooting in New York, and now that I have a son, and when he gets into school, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, like, for real, like, some people, I think, love that they just have a job. Like, some people want, like, a big part of the appeal of acting for them is that they're doing a very different thing every time they get a job, and that they're always jumping off a cliff and learning something. But I think there are plenty of great actors who are just thrilled that they can, like, go and act every day, and that's the part of it that's important to them. So that's a dream job.
Yeah, I guess it would depend on the job and like where I am in my life. I remember like Big Love, that character couldn't have been more complicated. And I mean, to me, she was the best character on the show, but of course I played her. But after a while, you're like, really, this problem again? I have to deal with this again? And I'm like, yes, well, that's real life. You have the same problems over and over. So even in that environment, I remember getting frustrated at like the repetition of it. But I might feel differently now.
You are famously well-dressed. And I think I always think, she looks great. What a great outfit. Anytime I see a picture of you in an outfit.
Thanks, Jesse. I appreciate that.
I mean it. I will say, though, that like when I had a Still have, but I'm not super active in writing for it. But I had a menswear blog for a long time. And like the part of, I loved writing about clothes. I love clothes. But the thing where me showing that I cared about it, people often felt like I was in demonstrating that, judging them. And that also, like, they should definitely judge me because I was interested in it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, gosh, you had to deal with that, but like in the New York Post or whatever, not on Reddit. I don't want to deal with it on Reddit.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of my job. I mean, you know, I'm a public person. There were the, like, wanting to wear things and knowing that I would just get ripped to shreds because of who I was, you know, people. I somehow got into that box where, like, you know, say Rihanna was wearing it, people were like, oh, it's fabulous, but I'm wearing it. Like, what was she thinking? Somehow for a minute I was that for like the Us Weeklies. And I mean, it's the same thing now, like with Instagram, one bad comment and that's all you think about out of, you know, 5,000 great comments, you know, so it was... So there was that for a while, like in the early 2000s, when those magazines were, you know, ubiquitous and, you know, people, everybody looked at them.
Did you find that that led you to be more or less invested in wearing something weird? Like, was your reaction to that? Oh, okay, well, then I'm just going to...
There was always a big divide for me between red carpet and my personal. Like, I feel like I never knew how to be myself on the red carpet. Like, I was always playing the part. And I was like, I still look at red carpet photos. I'm like, who is that? What is that? Who is that person? Like, I was, you know... But in real life, I was having a blast. When I was going out to clubs or on the street or whatever I was doing, traveling... Yeah, so, yeah, I'm still a little, the red carpet still evades me to a certain extent. It's very hard to dress fancy, you know?
Do you still make or alter your own clothes sometimes?
I do, yes. I really like working with denim. Yeah. I'm really into all the, like, Junya Watanabe denim stuff with the eyelets, and I'm always trying to make my own versions.
That rules. What's the last thing you made?
The last thing I made was like a denim and eyelet mini skirt. Yeah.
What do you do to put the eyelets in? Do you like punch? Is there a special punch of some kind?
No, like trimmings, like adding trimmings. Yes. With a sewing machine.
Got it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Where are you wearing that to? Whole Foods?
Sure. Yeah. Wherever.
Well, I sure appreciate you taking all this time to talk to me. It was really nice to get to talk to you. I so admire your work.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Chloe Sevigny. Catch her on Hulu's The Girl from Plainville or in the second season of Netflix's Russian Doll. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. The other day I came outside and everybody was out on the street on my block. And it turns out somebody in the middle of the day had just walked down the street carving the letter R into everyone's car hood. Gotta go to the body shop. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio, Valerie Moffett, and Richard Roby. Thanks to Catherine Cook at CDM Studios in New York City for recording my conversation with Chloe Sevigny. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It's recorded by the group The Go Team. Thanks to them and to their label Mantis Industries. Bullseye is on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. You can follow us in all of those places. We share our interviews there, and I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research uncovers emerging trends, then their technology curates relevant stocks into over 40 themes to choose from. Schwab investing themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Visit schwab.com/thematic investing.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little bricks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.